Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This weekend marked the 49th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, a landmark Supreme Court decision protecting the constitutional right to abortion. Pretty much ever since, anti-abortion activists have been fighting to overturn the ruling. And those in support of pro-choice say this year there is a real threat of that becoming a reality. Since Roe v. Wade's nearly five-decade history, states throughout the country have passed their own laws when it comes to abortion. And some of those interpretations have been challenged and made their way to higher courts. One of those is a Mississippi law which places heavy restrictions on abortion, banning most after 15 weeks of pregnancy. It's this law that the Supreme Court is hearing that challenges Roe v. Wade, and a decision is expected to be made later this year. In response, Democratic lawmakers in California are pushing for increased funding and resources for abortions and other reproductive care, and Governor Gavin Newsom's words becoming a sanctuary for a safe and legal abortion, even for those who come from out of state. Leading that charge is State Senate President pro tempore Tony Atkins. The Democrat represents the San Diego area. I spoke with pro tem Atkins to walk us through what's being proposed. Just starting off, you have a background in women's health. I mean, you led a clinic services center in San Diego going back more than three decades. What led you down this path?
Well, it's women's health issues. And in fact, I'm a feminist. I come to this from my experiences. And of course, back when I was running a women's health clinic in San Diego and Los Angeles, actually, we had two clinics. It was something I loved, women's health care. And I really felt even at that time that access to health care for women was a civil rights issue. And we saw women from across the border in Mexico who had a lack of access for abortion care. Our clinic was clearly larger than that. We did all types of health care, pap smears, referred for mammograms at that time, all kinds of services. But it was really the abortion care that was so critical to women in the communities. And of course, lo and behold, I never thought I would be an elected official and run for office, but that did happen. And I've been in office for almost 20 years now at the local and state level, but healthcare has continued to be something critically important to me, and particularly for women and our families.
You know, how did that experience shape your view of the right to abortion? Were there specific moments with patients or circumstances that helped you better understand the choice?
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of folks want to just condense this to the issue of abortion only, but it really is broader than that. Women's reproductive health care is much broader. So I'll tell you two quick. One, a woman, a military member of the military, came to our clinic, could not access abortion care on at the Naval Hospital. You cannot get abortions in medical facilities at bases. She sought us out to get an abortion. And while I was in the room with her, advocating for her, holding her hand, she started to ask me interesting questions. And it was about herpes. And lo and behold, I learned that she had herpes. And the reason she was there to get an abortion is she had misinformation about it would infect her baby. And therefore, she thought she had to get an abortion. Immediately, I brought in the doctor, who was a military doctor and working in our clinic. And he told her it wasn't necessarily true that she would pass herpes on to her newborn baby. And lo and behold, later, he became her doctor at Balboa Naval Hospital. She delivered a healthy baby, and she left the clinic that day fully informed of what her choices were. The other story is about a woman named Karen Bell, whose daughter, Becky Bell, died at age 17 of an illegal abortion because she couldn't get it safely in her home state of Indiana. She had to go through a judicial bypass and get permission from a judge, and she couldn't figure out how to do that. So she got an illegal abortion and she died. And it was only after that young woman died that her mother learned that she had an abortion. This woman was a Republican, anti-choice, and immediately she and her husband went around the country talking about the need for abortion access for young people because they lost their daughter. stories from women from Mexico who had lack of access. So for me, it is about self-determination, about women having all options available to them so they can do what is best for them at that point in time in their lives without judgment and with the right kind of healthcare information and support.
I'm curious, you know, because a piece of this conversation is the reality there are people who are against abortion. Each year on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, anti-abortion activists hold demonstrations. Is there any common ground that you share with those who have long been called pro-life? Are some of those people your loved ones or friends? And how do you navigate those conversations with them?
Absolutely. I mean, family members don't agree with me. I ran a clinic. But I understand how difficult and passionate these issues are. Heck, politics in my family is difficult. I'm a Democrat. Some members of my family are not. But I think it really is about allowing someone to make the decision. We have the responsibility ourselves to make decisions for ourselves and our families. And I just believe people need to have the support to be able to make the right decision for themselves. And so we can respectfully disagree, but I really think it's up to the individual. And I keep that in mind. I want to support anybody who wants to have an abortion, if that's their choice, have a child, make an even more difficult decision to give a child up for adoption if that is the choice they make. I really think our role is to be supportive in that decision making and let that individual make the decision with as much advice, resources as possible.
There is just so much happening at the national level with this issue. We're going to get to the Mississippi case in just a moment. But first, on Thursday, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of a Texas abortion law, which allows private citizens to sue those who perform abortions and makes no exceptions for rape or incest. But the law took effect 4 months ago. Did you see any impact or what kind of impact it did make to abortion access? And have there been ripple effects across the country from Texas?
Well, when these kinds of policies are put in place, absolutely ripple effects. When I talked to you about the young woman who died of an illegal abortion, that's because Indiana put into place something called judicial bypass, where young people had to go before a judge. When you put barriers in place for individuals to be able to access any kind of health care, there will be impacts. We are already seeing more women come to California for abortion. Now, what's sad about that is these are the women who can find the resources to get here, have the support to do it. What about women who don't have that support? And that's the thing that's so insidious about people that make decisions. I see abortion access and rights, much like the ability to have a child and have the support to get pregnant, as a civil rights issue for women. If we are not able to control our own bodies, So, this has always been core to me from the days that I worked at the women's health clinic. And yes, it's going to have a ripple effect. And yes, women will die. We already know we have an access issue for women in this country, despite the Affordable Care Act, despite all that California does to offer Medi-Cal, emergency services Medi-Cal. One day you can be eligible. And, you know, when you're pregnant, time is of the essence. Time is of the essence in terms of whether that procedure is going to be more costly or more physically challenging for you if you're less than 12 weeks or over 12 weeks. So, I mean, this is an attack on women. Let's be clear. People think we are out of bounds or we're dramatic women or emotional or hysterical. No, women will die. Women will die.
Let's now move to the Mississippi law that's being challenged by the state's lone abortion clinic in Mississippi. The law bans abortions after 15 weeks, except in the case of medical emergency or severe fetal abnormality, but it also doesn't make exemptions in cases of rape or incest. When it was signed into law in 2018, it was called the country's toughest abortion ban. With your perspective, has there been a similar case that compares to this Mississippi law in terms of opening the door to potentially overturning Roe versus Wade?
Well, I think, you know, in the 49 years that Roe versus Wade has been, you know, in the Constitution as a right to privacy for women, there have been attacks. And when one track doesn't work for those who oppose abortion across the board, regardless of anything, when one tack doesn't work, they use another tack and then another. I mean, I've been involved in this for more than 30 years. I remember Operation Rescue and blockading clinics. They got more strategic in terms of going after the policy that would license clinics. Can you do an abortion in an outpatient setting? Do you have to be in a hospital? All of those kinds of regulations. They've, tried one thing and then another and then another. And of course, we've fought parental notification and consent. We've waiting periods, ultrasounds, forcing women to get vaginal ultrasounds, which was a proposal out of my home state of Virginia, where I grew up. All of those things have been put forward. And really, we always knew abortion options were under attack. But now with the Supreme Court and the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, really never has there been more of a threat to the rights of reproductive rights for individuals in this country. And so it's been a steady drumbeat to get to this point. And so it is the most critical time I can ever remember in the history of this issue.
Some may think having 15 weeks is adequate when deciding whether to have an abortion. But with your background in women's health, can you explain why you view this as a problem?
Well, every woman's health situation is different. And I will tell you, I met young women who had no idea they were 20 weeks pregnant. I met, there's lots of reasons. And I experienced it firsthand. These are hard decisions for women. I don't want to say they're not. And sometimes women aren't able to get the money together to get the procedure. They're not able to get the support in place that they need to do it sooner. The sooner you can do it, the easier it is for you physically and expense-wise. And at the same time, when you put all these barriers up, all you're doing is preventing women from being able to do this sooner. And then, there are sad situations where, the viability of a fetus, of the baby may be in question, and you learn something. And then you have to make another difficult decision about whether you choose to take that pregnancy forward or not. I mean, I trust women with the support structures that they hopefully have. In many cases, like I said, women don't have the structure. But with the structure they have, whether it's with their doctor, their partner, their family, their priest, whatever their support structure is, I trust women to be able to make those decisions if they have the right kind of help.
If Roe versus Wade ends up being challenged or even potentially overturned with this decision, how would this impact the right to abortion in California?
Well, I think California, we have put this into our state constitution. So I feel pretty optimistic about California. But, you shouldn't be fortunate to be born in California to have access to healthcare services or education or childcare or anything else. You would like those things to be available to women and families across the country. So it's really going to be a sad thing of, oh, you were fortunate enough to be in California or to have the resources to get to California or other states that may follow suit. So it's why you see what the Women's Legislative Caucus is doing to make this a priority with the Future of Abortion Council and all of those partners. It's not just Planned Parenthood or NARAL. It's Latinas for Reproductive Justice. It's Black Women for Wellness. I mean, it is practitioners that are very concerned about making sure California has even more access, because we've had challenges with access in our own state, despite it being in our constitution to support it. So we want to be a beacon for others. We want to be able to help. And you're going to see a number of pieces of legislation. We just had a press conference yesterday, and some of that's going to be about how we provide support, financial and otherwise, to women, not just in California, but from other states. How are we going to protect them from liability of participating in helping someone get an abortion? All of those things are going to be discussed policy-wise and through our budget process in the coming weeks and months.
Okay, so that leads me to what the governor had said that California, in response, would become a sanctuary for those seeking abortions from out of state. Unpack that. What exactly does that mean for California?
I love thinking about California as a beacon of hope, because I think it's a very optimistic thing. I know the word sanctuary can be a little fraught for people, but it's really true. Women are going to need to be able to figure out where they can get the support, and there will be structures put into place like there always have been to try to help women to get that support. And it will mean that the future of abortion council, what they did was assess where we were already in terms of lack of access and barriers, and to try to strengthen that. So you're going to see what that may mean is how we look at providing reimbursement rates for abortion services, co-payments, transportation, training for providers. We know that we don't have enough providers, mid-level providers. I did a bill a number of years ago to allow certified nurse midwives, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants to do first trimester abortions. How do we expand that? And it may mean one of the legislators yesterday mentioned a bill that she's going to do to support a private fund that will be a public-private partnership for resources to go towards helping other women from across the country. So there have always been informal networks, Vicki. Always. I've always been part of organizations that raise money to be available for those in need. As I said, military women don't have access to abortion and to have it covered. So we've always had to provide some measure of support. We'll just expand those public-private kind of contributions, philanthropic donations. Those who are committed to this cause will double down and provide some additional support. But I do think it means if you want to call California a sanctuary place, we will be a sanctuary for women who need this.
You mentioned the military, and you also earlier talked about, you know, women who had come across from the Mexican border. Do you anticipate an increase or an influx of women from out of state seeking a safe and legal abortion? You touched upon in the beginning that you've already started to see an increase in this happening.
We have. And if you talk to providers like Planned Parenthood and others, they will tell you they've noticed an increase. And, you know, we keep that data and that information. But yes, we're already seeing an increase, and we anticipate we will see more. And what's really sad, Vicki, is there will be women who are not able to get that help and assistance to find a place to get a safe, legal abortion. And they'll either, you know, they'll either be forced to have children they're not prepared to have, or they will find someone that will do the procedure and it may not be safe.
If this continues to increase, or just even as it stands now, does California logistically have the resources and providers and even the money available to actually shoulder this?
No, we are not an open checkbook. We don't have an open checkbook for all kinds of needs. You know, you were witnessing California just beginning to expand healthcare to include healthcare for undocumented residents of our state who pay taxes, by the way, and who cost taxpayers money if we're not providing preventative care or healthcare. So no, we don't have the ability to help everyone, but I'll tell you what, I believe in California's values, and we will help as many people as we can in partnership with those who care about providing that support for women. So we will find a way, and we will help some women, and we will make a difference in those lives. I know that we will. I've seen it. I've been part of it. And I know that it does make a difference.
The governor's budget proposal, we do have a budget surplus that this go around. It does include funding for abortion. And obviously the state budget is not final, but can you run through the main specifics of this funding proposal?
I think, it was a list of a number of recommendations out of this council made up of all these 40 different organizations to talk about what the barriers and challenges were. So yes, some of it will be additional resources to help cover the cost of abortion. Some of it will be resources to help with the workforce issues, which is to make sure that there's the proper training and ability. It will be about telehealth care, because those may be more accessible ways to provide follow-up care to people who've accessed the service. It will be, looking at reimbursement rates, so that providers are able to actually, expand their services. So there's all kinds of things in that report that talks about what we need to do with our structure in California to be more prepared to give those services to women who live in California, but also over and above that, women who may be coming here from elsewhere.
Hmm. I guess finally, what more needs to be done? Because there's still plans and works, and this is still taking formation. Is the state going to foot the majority of this funding, or are there private funding opportunities and partnerships? And if so, what organizations or people or sectors are we talking about, or do you envision?
You know, we are just in the middle of a budget process, so that's going to be the deliberation and the discussion going forward. I think it will definitely take private resources and support. And we've seen any number of philanthropic and private donors who have, that you probably have never heard about, that have supported these clinics over the years to help them expand services. Tons of Planned Parenthood supporters, a lot of smaller clinics. You know, you have people step forward when they see what happens when the service isn't available. And I anticipate all of that will be part of what we do on the structure. So it won't all be state. It will be private and philanthropic. And, you know, all of these organizations that realize that the women who are disproportionately impacted, the individuals disproportionately impacted, you will not be shocked to learn, also include women of color, Black women, Latinas, API community, you know, they know, and that's why they're part of this coalition to figure out how to strengthen what we have. But, you know, we hope to do as much as we can. And at the same time, you know, California has lots of other needs which support families and women, childcare, access to education. So we have to balance all those things. But I look forward to a pretty robust discussion. And we'll do some policy things as well as budget.
Before we let you go, how do you think the Supreme Court is going to rule?
Oh, golly. You know, I don't feel overly optimistic here, which makes me so sad. It makes me so incredibly sad that in my lifetime, that what I get to see is the erosion of something that's been so fundamentally important to the civil rights of women. I can hope for better. I'm always hopeful. I'm always hopeful, but we will be prepared should things not go our way. And, you know, I just think it's time for those who care about the total reproductive health care options for women and our families to double down and triple down. This is critical. It really is, Vicki, a civil rights issue for women.
And that is State Senate President pro tempore Tony Atkins. The Democrat represents the San Diego area and is leading the charge for the state to increase abortion funding and resources. In the governor's words, becoming a sanctuary for a safe and legal abortion. As the Supreme Court decides a Mississippi case that can challenge the nearly 50-year-old landmark ruling of Roe versus Wade. Up next, Cap Radio's Ed Fletcher shares his conversations with volcano and tsunami scientists about the lessons learned about the Tonga eruption that captivated the world. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. An underwater volcanic eruption unleashed a sonic boom heard thousands of miles away, thrust ash 100,000 feet into the sky, and triggered a tsunami with effects felt as far away as the U.S. West Coast. Videos from across the coast showed people at beaches watching the seawater recede. Soon, the tsunami waves began to flood in. While the waves on our coast weren't as large and destructive as some we've seen in years past, and in other places throughout the world, they were still pretty impressive. To talk about his reporting on the volcanic disturbance and ensuing tsunami is Cap Radio's Ed Fletcher. Thanks for being here, Ed.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
Well, before we get into the science of what actually happened, remind us what happened and how the local population is doing.
Yeah, I'll give you an update on where things stand, but let's let Michael Poland, a geophysicist with the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, explain what happened.
There's an underwater volcano there that had been showing some intermittent eruptive activity since late December. And then on that Saturday evening local time, it had a really large explosion. It did not put that much material into the atmosphere, but the explosion it generated was really massive. In fact, it was heard as far away as at least Alaska. And the pressure wave from this has been recorded all around the world. It also generated a tsunami that, of course, impacted the coast of California, Pacific Northwest, Alaska, Hawaii. It was really seen Pacific-wide, even on Japan. This was a really noteworthy volcanic event. And what makes it even more interesting from a volcanological point of view was that it wasn't a massive eruption. It was not a lot of material did not come out of the ground for this, but it generated a really outsized explosion and tsunami for that amount of material that did come out.
The main island of Tonga, which is about 40 miles from the eruption site, was struck very hard by the tsunami and was covered with ash. There have been at least 3 deaths linked to the event, but it took some time just to get any information out of the situation because the underwater data cable linking the island to the internet was damaged. On Friday, the first planes carrying fresh water and supplies were able to land after the runway was cleared. And New Zealand and Australia have been leading the efforts, but we should note that Tonga has been opting for a contactless relief efforts. They've only had one case of COVID and they want to keep it that way. The island inhabitants could face both short and long-term health impacts from the toxic ash. People have been instructed to wear masks to protect their lungs, and the ash made the island's water undrinkable and could damage crops going forward.
Yeah, this is far from over. The tsunami reached the California coast. What did we actually see and feel here on our coast?
Yeah, the waves created by this volcanic eruption traveled thousands of miles across the Pacific Ocean, with several places recording a 3-foot surge. I want to first hear from a Santa Cruz boat owner who sort of describes the storm, and then we'll hear from the scientists, and they'll talk about why they may have misjudged this eruption. This is Tom Halderman at a marina in Santa Cruz, and this sound is from Jeremiah Oding with KAVU in Monterey.
Oh yeah, the surge was impressive. It came in rapidly filling, and it raised the ramp here at the kayak dock up until the dock was above the level of the sidewalk, and it surged up over the ice plant and into the parking lot and flooded the parking lot all the way from here up to where their boats are in dry storage up at the other end of the harbor. Very impressive amount of water that came into the harbor. Luckily, things have stayed put and stayed together, and things aren't floating away, and no drama.
So as you can hear there, some level of damage, some level of a disruption, but nothing like they suffered on the island there. So getting a little in towards the science, most tsunamis like the 2011 event that decimated parts of Japan are triggered by earthquakes. Here's a bit of my conversation with Bojan Bang, a scientist with the National Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer, Alaska.
Is it unusual for volcanic activity to trigger waves like this?
It is very unusual. I've been here for 10 years. I've never seen like this. Most of tsunamis are triggered by earthquakes, probably 70 or 80%, not for volcanic activity. I think I heard that this is the most powerful tsunami created by volcanic eruption in 30 years. We're not prepared well for this kind of type of tsunami genesis. So basically, our operation is based on the assumption that earthquake generated tsunami. And we have a forecasting system. The forecasting system is being adjusted on the way by the observations, just like a weather forecast.
Yeah, so the operative words I'm focusing on are unusual and that also that they weren't prepared for something like this. Were you surprised by that response?
I was really surprised at how willing he was able to say that they weren't ready for this. They first issued an advisory and then had to upgrade that. And then the results were actually greater than they expected. You expect that these warning centers have all the answers, but it's clear they're still learning how to predict these things. Bo Bang at the Tsunami Warning Center said they've enhanced their models since the Japanese quake, but they just weren't prepared for a volcanic-driven tsunami. As I've learned from Michael Poland at the Volcano Warning Center, the majority of the Earth's volcanoes are underwater, but most are way down deep, not close to the surface, like the event near Tonga.
Well, given that a volcanic-driven tsunami is rare, and we're learning this from scientists, let's talk more about this volcanic explosion. Do we know why it resulted in such a powerful event?
Here's Michael Poland on that question.
Well, it almost certainly has to do with the interaction with seawater. We don't have a good handle on the dynamics of magma-water interactions. That's something that we're still learning an awful lot about. And that seems like that probably is what drove a lot of what we saw in this particular eruption. The plume went very, very high and was a very large eruption cloud for the amount of material that came out. And we've seen this sort of thing in other eruptions that have involved water, especially ocean water mixing with volcanoes that are right at sea level or just below sea level. So magma-water interaction must have played a huge role in making this such a large explosion.
Well, that is so interesting. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio's Ed Fletcher about his conversations with volcano and tsunami scientists about the eruption near the island of Tonga. So are volcanoes like earthquakes? Is one event likely to trigger other eruptions?
I asked Michael Poland that very question, and he says no. It's called the Ring of Fire, but they're not connected. So while we are likely to see continued activity with this volcano near Tonga, and there was activity before that big eruption, but we're unlikely to see volcanic activity in California as a result.
And I'm sure, you know, many of our listeners know that there are volcanoes in California going up through the West Coast. But for those that don't, kind of lay out the landscape for us.
Yeah, I knew that Crater Lake in Oregon was caused by a volcano. I camped there as a boy. And I knew Mount Lassen was volcanic, but I was surprised by the number of volcanoes in the region. Here's Michael Poland.
Well, there are absolutely volcanoes in California. There are the Northern Cascades, like Mount Lassen and Shasta and Medicine Lake. Clear Lake is an active volcanic area. The Mono Inyo area and Mammoth area has active volcanism. Salton Buttes down near the Salton Sea has some relatively young volcanism. None of these things have erupted particularly recently, with the exception of Lassen in the early 1900s. And then a few hundred years ago, there was some activity among the Mono Inyo craters, sort of north of Mammoth.
So Poland does note that there is a volcano warning center in California. And he went on to talk about how important it is to monitor volcanoes closely to give us as much warning as possible before an eruption.
Given all the climate emergencies that we've seen in recent years, did you have a conversation about whether this eruption is in any way related to our changing climate?
Michael Poland, who happens to be from Carmichael, he says no. The eruption was a natural event, and basically that if too much pressure builds up, volcanoes explode. But on a related note, there was some initial question over whether shooting all that ash into the air might actually cool the planet.
We don't expect there to be much in the way of climate impacts from this eruption. Early on, when people were looking at the size of the plume, there was some speculation that this might lead to perhaps a slight impact on global climate. This has happened from past volcanic eruptions that were really, really big, where enough ash and gas was put into the atmosphere that actually caused a small amount of cooling, a degree Fahrenheit or so globally. The last time that really happened was 1991 with the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. But this eruption, even though it was a very impressive one, didn't release enough material to really cause those effects. So we don't expect to see much in the way of a global impact from this.
You know, Ed, we've been talking about an event where the biggest impacts were half a planet away, but you actually have some firsthand experience with the tsunami.
That's right. I was in Japan during the 2011 quake and catastrophic tsunami.
Yeah, that was more than a decade ago. Why were you there and what was that like?
Yeah, I was there as part of a cultural tour of journalists organized by the East-West Center. We met government officials up and down the country talking about the U.S.-Japan alliance. And there had been a quake prior to that day, but the day of the big quake, we had just boarded a plane to Okinawa, and we were in the air when the magnitude 9.0 quake hit. So when we landed, we started to see images on television and including news people wearing hard hats, but not knowing the language and not really getting the full picture, I didn't know how serious it was. A little while later, we met with the governor of the prefecture, and he continued our meeting, didn't cancel our meeting, but he showed up in overalls and told us many people would die. Sadly, that proved to be true, with more than 18,000 people killed as a result of the event. We did adjust our tour slightly and got different speakers along the way, but I and the other journalists continued the tour and left the country several days later.
Well, given that we've passed 10 years of that earthquake and tsunami in Japan, in the time since you experienced it firsthand and you know what you know now with hindsight 2020, how do you reflect on that trip and how did it shape you as a journalist or even a person?
Well, one thing it really gave me is a greater appreciation for the work that foreign correspondents do. It's hard enough to report in the country you live in. It's a whole nother thing to be in a foreign environment where the government may be less willing to provide you information, and you have to rely on the resources of other people to help get those stories out. I've got good friends that have done foreign correspondence work, and many of our group thought about, well, should we try to leave this tour and go see what happened? And the logistics of it just became overwhelming. So most of us stayed with the tour, but as we said, adjusted our tour a little bit. But, you know, it really drove home the importance of getting information from the world to Americans, and we don't put enough emphasis in that these days.
I imagine that experience had a lot to do with you pursuing this story to learn more about the volcanic eruption and subsequent tsunami near Tonga.
Oh, no, I'm never in the business of turning down stories, but I was definitely really interested and wanted to make more calls and really kind of understand this. I saw firsthand the damage that tsunamis can do. And so I've done some reading since then, and just the dynamics of the coast make such a big difference. And I hadn't even thought about volcanic driven tsunamis and how that might change the equation. So a lot of fascinating stuff there, and I was definitely very interested to learn more.
Well, thanks for pursuing it, Ed. Ed, I think we all learned a lot. I sure did.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And that is Cap Radio's Ed Fletcher. Still ahead, a 16-year-old musical prodigy and UC Davis student celebrates a rare, coveted national award. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi, Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. She's a member of both the exclusive Mensa and Phi Theta Kappa Societies, a University Regents and Honors Program scholar at UC Davis. Her soaring soprano opera voice has been heard at Carnegie Hall, the Vatican, and before the first pitch at the San Francisco Giants games. And did we mention she just celebrated her Sweet 16 in December? Yes, Tiara Abraham's remarkable mind and singing talent has helped her achieve a lifetime's worth of accomplishments in her first 16 years. Although she doesn't have a driver's license just yet, this Sacramento teenager became the only young artist from the Sacramento-Davis region to earn a 2022 Young Arts Award, recognizing the nation's most accomplished young artists for their contributions in the visual, literary, and performing arts. Joining us now is the teenage musical prodigy who is set to graduate this June from UC Davis with a bachelor's in music, Tiara Abraham. Tiara, welcome to Insight and congratulations on your most recent achievement.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You began classical voice lessons at 7 years old, but you truly started singing around the house at age 4. Tell us more about that and the types of songs that you would sing.
Yeah, so I started singing around 4. That's kind of when my parents noticed that, you know, I was singing differently, not like other 4-year-olds. Like, I had vibrato, and I was just singing like simple songs, like, you know, happy birthday, and but, you know, like, it was not just straight tone, you know, it had, you know, that classical voice. And it was until 7 that my parents realized that I enjoyed, you know, singing, especially when my brother was attending San Francisco Boys Chorus. And so I would kind of pick up the songs that he was learning and sing around the house also. And so then around 7, my parents and I found a voice teacher who was willing to, you know, teach me, you know, like classical techniques, so I can sing healthily.
Yeah, as we just mentioned, in December, you received a Young Arts Award. What does receiving this award mean to you?
Yeah, I received the Young Arts Award, which is a really prestigious program. You know, only around 10% are chosen of the applicants are chosen, and so it's really exciting to be a part of this, you know, talented group of individuals. And, you know, they provide so many opportunities, both creative and financial support, and to be a part of a group like of alumni who are, like, you know, Timothy Chalamet and Amanda Gorman and Viola Davis. That's really exciting to be a part of the same group. So,
I mean, yeah, that's just incredible. I mean, you also, what's also incredible, you graduated high school at 13 and became a full-time student at American River College at 14. And then after American River College, you transferred to UC Davis. What was it like being in a classroom of students who were 5 to 10 years older than you?
But when I transferred to UC Davis, I was quite used to it because, you know, I've been in college since I was 7. I started community college when I was 7. So I guess at that time, it was kind of different. You know, a lot of my classmates were definitely older than me. And, like, in fact, like, one of my classmates was like 70 plus. I don't know how, but we were, you know, really close classmates. And but a lot of my classmates thought that I was, you know, just attending because my mom was accompanying me. So they thought that my mom was the student. But when they realized that I was the student, I guess they were a little shocked. But, yeah, when I transferred to UC Davis, you know, I was 14, and it was also online, you know, because of the whole pandemic, I transferred. So, you know, a lot of the students actually didn't know that I was 14, but when they did, you know, they were also pretty cool about it, so.
Well, let's get to it. I want to listen to one of the songs from a performance, and it's an aria composed by the great Johann Sebastian Bach. So let's take a quick listen. Sing in 6 different languages, Spanish, French, Italian, German, Latin, and of course English. Is there a language you enjoy singing in more? Do you have a favorite?
That is a hard question. I enjoy singing in French and Italian. I just love the challenge of French. I mean, there's so many tongue twisters. And Italian is just such a beautiful, you know, romance language. So I think those would be my 2 favorites.
Well, let's listen to another song. This is Ridente la Calma. Let's take a brief listen and then we can talk about it after. I have to ask, you come from a family of scientists and you're pursuing singing with such a beautiful voice. Where do you get the confidence to do this?
Well, my family, you know, they're both scientists and engineers, but they've also been really supportive of, you know, my passion for music and the arts. And so, you know, I have such a supportive, you know, family and, you know, my brother, who's also, you know, he's also academically advanced, and he, you know, he always says to do what you enjoy, because, you know, I'd rather do what I enjoy than, you know, doing something that, you know, I'm just doing for the sake of it. And, you know, I do it well, you know, I enjoy singing, and I sing well also, so.
We're going to hear one last song from your recital at UC Davis. And on top of all of this, you also play the piano. So let's listen to the classic Summertime and take a brief listen.
Summertime.
I just love that, Tiara. In October, I was looking at your Twitter and you saw opera great Andrea Bocelli. And in your tweet, you had said that looks like I may be the only one under 18 in the house. Am I strange to love classical and opera? What's the future of opera? As someone who very likely is the future of opera, what do you think the future holds for you and how and your generation getting more involved in classical music?
Yeah, when I attended Andrea Bocelli's concert, I was like literally like the only, yeah, like one under 18, which was interesting. But I definitely, I really applaud Andrea Bocelli's effort in, you know, bringing, you know, opera to the mainstream. And I think that's really important, especially when a lot of young people, young listeners are, you know, they kind of are put off by the myth that, you know, opera is, you know, this elite genre. You know, you attend the opera house wearing a tuxedo or a dress. And I just, you know, I want people to know that, you know, opera is relatable. I mean, you know, there are, you know, big, you know, topics like, you know, like back in the day, but at the end of the day, it's the music and the story is supposed to be relatable. And we can also, as composers, make it relatable, you know, bringing awareness to social issues and causes. So both as performers and composers, I think definitely in the future, opera should, you know, just be, you know, relevant to the 21st century. And that's our goal as musicians, how to make it relevant. So,
well, thank you so much, Tiara, for sharing all of your gifts with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that is Tiara Abraham, a 16-year-old UC Davis Region Scholar and the only young artist from the Sacramento Davis region to receive a 2022 Young Arts Award. Tiara will graduate from UC Davis in June. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. In the meantime, here's more of Tiara when I have sung my songs.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.